Hey, 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 closet busters and bold move makers. It is time once again for Life Uncloset. So I want you to gather around because it is time once again to kick down those closet doors of your life. We're here to escape our BS, explore our fears, and elevate our self-expression. I'm your host, Rick Clemons. I'm the bold move expert and that coming out guy who's going to take you to the party, the pulpit, the wake, and back to the party of living your life uncloset. So come on along with me and grab hold of yourself and get ready to step out, step up, and step into facing your fears, making your bold moves, and living life without apologies. Now let's get to the show. Hello, Life Uncloseted family. We are moving along in the new year and marching forward, and lots of stuff is going on in the world. And sometimes we wonder, okay, how do we keep all this straight? How do we understand people's perspectives and the way they want to show up in the world? And today I'm going to pose a question to you. Do you think you can be a progressive Christian and be LGBTQ? Do you think you can be a Christian and be LGBTQ? Do you think you can stand in the face of inequality and go, wait, we're missing some pieces? Because that's what we're going to be talking about today, is you can't just say it's one way or the other. There's so many layers to equality and Christianity and progressive Christianity and being LGBTQ. And when today's guest approached me and said, my hand's up, I'd really like to talk to you, Rick, I was like, absolutely, because she has a couple of new books coming out. I'm going to let her talk about those. Plus, she has a great queer music, sacred music site coming out as well. And I just feel like Amanda would be a great guest to talk about all these interesting things that bring us together as a society. Her name is Amanda Yudis Kessler, and she's a sociologist, a writer, a songwriter, and you probably picked up a progressive Christian. And she also happens to be bisexual, so that's why she is here. Not just because she's bisexual, but because she's bringing so many interesting layers to our conversation. So, Amanda, I am really looking forward to where we go in this conversation today. And by the way, congrats on two new books coming out in 24. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So two books. Wow. You're a busy beaver this year, getting two books out. That's got to be a really exciting venture for you, I would imagine.
It is. Last year was when I actually wrote the texts of both books. And that was a number of months worth of slog. And I did it on top of a full-time day job, but that's done. So I'm now into the marketing, and that's its own project, but it's worthwhile. I think the ideas in the books are interesting, controversial, hopefully helpful. So we'll see how they go.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, you've got a couple of fronts that you're right in the mix of everything that's kind of showing up in our world big time right now, between Christianity and, you know, how do we stand in that space if that's what we choose and believe in? And then, you know, this cultural inequality stuff that's showing up on every front, like, where does it show up? Whether you're Jewish, whether you're LGBTQ, whether you're Black, whether you're a person of color, whether you're a woman, whether you're a Christian. I mean, all of this stuff we're in the culture war. So let's just be honest about that. That's where we are. So you're a sociologist, so I get that this was probably always been in your quote DNA, but how has your work said, hey, it's time for me to really go write these books? Was this like something you always knew you wanted to like get these kind of messages out? Or was there an inciting moment that you finally said, yes, it's time to write these books?
So the stories of the two books are quite different. I spent a number of years before I transitioned from Unitarian Universalism into Progressive Christianity as a lay preacher. So I'm not ordained, but I did a lot of preaching in UU churches, and I developed the ideas that are now the heart of the Progressive Christian Ethic of Flourishing book, actually in a UU context. I was trying to come up with a way of thinking about ethics that made more sense for me, and that was social justice driven and reflected my feminism and my leftism and all that. After I made the transition into progressive Christianity, I realized that this way of thinking about ethics worked really well with progressive Christianity. It's not restricted to it. It is a secular ethic, but it actually interweaves really nicely with progressive Christianity. And as it happened, I got a contract from a progressive Christian press. And so that was the way that book moved forward. The Cultural Processes of Inequality book, which helps people think about the ideas and meaning systems and cultural processes that drive racism, sexism, heterosexism, and so on. That's a book I've wanted to write for a long time, but the main driver on its timing was that there was a press in Great Britain that had been inviting me to write for them for years. And finally I said, okay, here's a book proposal. And I had just started writing the ethics book and I thought there's no way they're going to accept my proposal right now. So, of course they did. So I wrote two books, but, those ideas I've been developing for 20 years, 30 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got my doctorate in 2002, so it's been a good generation.
So let's start with the progressive Christian one. You obviously are rooted in faith in your own space, I would assume. And yet one of the most conflicting things that happens for most of us in the LGBTQ space is many of us do come from a place of some form of faith. And then we get beat up by that faith for being LGBTQ. So how has this book and you coming through your own journey helped you reconcile? I can be Christian, progressive Christian, and I can be part of the LGBTQ community.
So I actually started life as a secular Jew, but I was on a spiritual quest probably from my teen years on. And it could have taken a lot of forms. I spent 30 years with the Unitarian Universalists, and those were rich years, and I don't regret them at all. But I think my very first sense that there was something potentially beautiful about something in the vision of Christianity came when I was in high school, and I music directed a production of Godspell in New York City. Mm. And that experience was really emotionally powerful. I didn't know why, but I began to study comparative religion academically. I actually majored in it in college. When I found the UUs, I thought, here's a place I can have a religious practice that doesn't require me to believe doctrines, because I was pretty sure I didn't believe Christian doctrines. And again, I hadn't grown up in Christianity, so I didn't have to rebel from it or wrestle through it. But of course, I grew up in a country saturated with Christian homophobia and heterosexism. I mean, I'm 58. Yep. So, you know, I remember as a kid in New York going to Pride marches and seeing the protesters. It was horrible. But what eventually happened over many years was I read as much as I could about how different Christians thought about sexuality. You know, I came out as bisexual quite young. And so I knew that any religious tradition I engaged with was going to have to be completely welcoming. That was non-negotiable. And what eventually happened was, over the years, the kind of mainline strand of Christianity became more progressive. So during my decades with the Unitarian Universalists, I began to see that there was some space in Christianity. And in fact, that Christianity did not only have the one form that we see so publicly, this very literalist, fundamentalist, doctrinally driven, exclusivist form, that there were many ways one could approach this. And so in my several year approach to progressive Christianity, I sort of became clear that I could enter it in a not particularly doctrinal way. I could enter it as someone besotted with this vision Jesus had about what the world could look like. And that this was not about me believing a bunch of doctrines. This was about me signing on to a way of trying to live and be in the world. I'm not an exclusivist. I'm a universalist. I'm not particularly doctrinal. My choice, my passion at this point, is to follow this particular way. But I think there are many good ways of being religious. I think there are many ways of being a good person in the world. Many of my best friends are completely secular people, and I love them, and I don't judge them. I don't think they're doing anything wrong. Our paths are our paths. We find our way to them. We build them ourselves. It's complicated.
Well, it's very complicated. And I love what you just said. Our paths are our paths. And I find in my quest for how do I balance, you know, my belief systems and my faith and my spirituality, that as soon as I quit saying this is the only path, which was very much a very fundamentalist Christian way, I started feeling much more at peace, Amanda. I'm like, okay, there's many ways to spirituality and God and faith. And I wish more people would embrace that intention. Like, we can all have, I mean, at the gist of every faith, it's about something greater than ourselves. Let's just be honest. If we could all just operate in that space instead of, okay, now we have to be right. And that's where I've always had a real challenge growing up. How do I phrase this? Growing up in a, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do, so let's go do it, was really not really brainwashing, but it's like, okay, I'm just doing this because this is what I'm told to do. And it wasn't until I hit college that I started really questioning. And it's ironic. The one thing that made me question it more than anything, well, a couple things. I'd had a really cruddy experience in high school going to a Seventh-day Adventist high school where everything was, you have to do this. You have to show up for worship. You have to show up for a week of prayer. You have, you know, and then I had an incident where a principal said, because, you know, 70s kid, and we came from California to Colorado, and, you know, or we went from California to Colorado, Colorado to Arkansas, and in Arkansas is where I was going to high school. And the principal said to my parents, we're glad you're here for a week of prayer, but Christian boys don't wear their hair below their ears. And that was like the first thing I was just like, oh my gosh. By the time I hit college, I was already in that space of, if this is really what religion is about, I'm checked out. I am checking out. Yet I went to college at a Seventh-day Adventist college because this is what I was supposed to do. And the moment, and I played the piano. That was one of the things I loved doing. I played the piano. And the moment I was told, okay, you have to play the piano to get a grade, that kind of was like, okay, well, I'm not a music major. So that kind of took the wind out of my sails. Oh, and you can only play this kind of music. I'm like, I'm done. I'm literally, and that was actually the kingpin of me starting to really get out and start exploring other religions and other faiths. And I always found it interesting, Amanda, that, you know, core curriculum at many schools, even, you know, any university can be a world religions class. And when the world religions instructor said, we're going to explore this with the understanding that our religion is the religion, I was just like, I am now double checked out. I am completely double checked out. Because to me, this is where the cult mentalities and everything in my mind show up. So as you have written this book and you know, it's really a progressive Christian ethic of flourishing. What does flourishing Christian look like based on what you've learned and what you brought into your own world and in the book?
I want to say that my vision of flourishing is in no way restricted to any one group of people. In fact, it's a really universalist vision. And I think what makes the book unique is actually not how it ties to progressive Christianity, though that will be interesting for some people, but what it means by an ethic of flourishing. And so what I've done is I've tried to approach this actually like a sociologist. And I've said, what are the kind of non-negotiable things about being a human being? And I'll just take the simplest example. Mm-hmm. We are embodied creatures.
Yep.
You know, we are also emotional. We are also meaning making. We are creative. We are relational. We're a lot of things. But if we stick with being embodied, because human beings are embodied, flourishing, getting to have a good life, must include flourishing in our bodies. If we're not flourishing in our bodies, we might flourish in some other ways, but our capacity to have kind of a holistic good life is limited. Mm-hmm. And so I've asked questions like, you know, what do we need to flourish in our bodies? We need safety. We need food and water. We need shelter. We need clothing. We need access to medicine and so on. We need access to bodily pleasure. We need to be able to use our bodies in the service of agency. So to do things with our bodies in the world and so on. And so just as a very tiny example of how this ethic works, beliefs, values, actions, institutions that are good for our bodies are good for our flourishing and are morally good. Beliefs, values, actions, institutions, and so on that are bad for our bodies are morally problematic. So that mm-hmm. means that I actually would go so far as to say that there are elements of conservative and fundamentalist Christianity that are, by this definition particularly, morally bad. because they are bad for our bodies. So this is a very unusual approach to ethics. It does not start with abstract concepts like justice or duty or care. It starts with, what do we need in our material lives and in our meaning-making lives and in our relationships to live well? So that's kind of a broad take on the idea of flourishing. Where I think this has to do with religion, any religion, but including progressive Christianity, is religion can help us flourish when it invites us to be our best selves and to take care of one another. And so one of the things I've done in the second half of the book, where I sort of turn to the progressive Christian connection, is to say, you know, there are many, many ways we can envision God or the sacred or that which is greater than us, the ground of being and so on. And if we think about God as love or love as sacred, then what does it mean to love ourselves and what does it mean to love one another? And so the claim I make in this part of the book, and again, I don't think this is restricted to progressive Christianity, but it works with it, is loving ourselves is tending to our own flourishing. Loving other people is tending to their flourishing. So that means that for me to love you is to treat you well and help you live well in your body and be a political activist to make sure that you have the rights that you need to live and the resources that you need to live and so on. And here's where it gets controversial. Loving our enemies, which is something that in Christianity we are strongly invited to do, in my way of thinking, means making sure that our enemies have a chance to flourish. It doesn't mean buying into their program. It doesn't mean that for me to love my fundamentalist enemies, I have to agree with them or support what they're doing. But it means I have to care about their well-being. So a little controversial, but that's sort of where I've landed.
But as controversial as it is, it's actually very, in my mind at least, it's very logical. I love what you just said about loving, you know, loving someone else and tending helps, you know, showing that love to someone else is helping them flourish, and loving ourselves is helping us flourish. Yes, there's always going to be, and I always say, you know, it's kind of like when people say, you know, the airplane, you know, the oxygen mask on the airplane, right?
Yep.
It isn't being selfish, but it is, it does walk that fine line. Like if you go too far one direction, then it's all about you. And as I've worked with so many people coming out of the closet, and this is one of my standards, and you know, there may be people listening, you're like, oh, I've thought about working with Rick, you know, having him as I go through the journey. I will not work with anybody who comes to the potential work with me who says, well, you know, I've given so much to everybody else. It's really all about me and me going and living my own life and being who I'm supposed to be. And everybody else just going to have to step in line. I can't work with a person like that. I won't work with a person like that because I was actually that person. And I saw the damage that that did. To the point that I almost, in some cases, could have lost so many things, my children, my ability for friendships and all this sort of stuff. And I find that if you can see it for what it is, like this beautiful, like, yes, take care of you. By taking care of you, you're actually better at taking care of other people. And the resentment is, there's not as much room for resentment. Like, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing for you, right? Because we're humans. This is one of the human nature traits. Like we want to do this and then we want something in return, especially in today's culture where it's all about me, 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 selfie, 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 da, 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 da. It's almost as if we have created a space where it can only be about you and kind of screw everybody else. And I think what I'm hearing through what your words and what you've shared is flourishing can mean we can all flourish. But let's put it in the proper perspective so that we don't either hurt somebody else or we overgive and then we're hurting ourselves. So I love that, Amanda. That's a beautiful, beautiful space. As you were putting the book together, I'm sure like most of us who write books, there were probably moments where you're like, oh, there's an aha moment that I didn't anticipate in myself that showed up. I'm sure some of that happened for you as well.
The thing is, The big aha moment for me was actually the moment when I went, you know, this is a really completely secular, progressive, almost leftist sort of justice focused ethic. And the moment when I realized it actually worked well in this progressive religious context, and incidentally, I should say, you know, had my own trajectory been Buddhist or Muslim or something like that, on the progressive side, I still think I would have seen those connections. Because ultimately, you know, when you study comparative religion academically, which I did before I studied sociology, you acknowledge and you really want to honor and respect the differences between different religious traditions, and between different strands within a tradition. I mean, progressive Christianity and conservative Christianity are really different. But all religion at its best comes down to love and compassion. And the specifics are really different. The rituals are different. The beliefs can be really different. But I think virtually any good religious life and virtually any good secular life is filled with love and compassion, creativity, patience. I mean, there are virtues that are in fact universal. They just take different shapes in different contexts. There's one other thing I want to say that isn't about the book, but that just seems so important given the nature of what this show is for you, which is that I think it's possible to talk about the coming out process, whatever the specifics are, as a way of helping oneself flourish. Because in terms of our need for meaning systems and ways of understanding the world that are healthy for us and holistic and that enable us to live well and relate to ourselves and relate to other people. If we have some identity that we are not acknowledging as true for ourselves or are not sharing with other people as that is sort of safe and appropriate, we're losing some of our capacity for joy and freedom and so on. And so even though I don't talk about it at all in the book, I think that coming out in almost any situation where what you're coming out about is in fact a good thing. I mean, I can't speak to coming out as a Nazi. That feels a little sort of outside of this, but you know, coming out as an LGBTQ person, coming out as having a particular religious trajectory, you know, telling a truth about yourself that is a decent truth and a joyful truth is part of having our lives be, as I've started to say, less hateful and more grateful. So I'm really glad you do this show, and I'm really glad you've done it for so long. And I think that sort of thinking about coming out and being our whole selves and sharing that with people as we can, not in an antagonistic way and not in a way that demands certain things of other people. You know, when I talk about religion, I don't do it to make anyone else think one way or another. I'm sharing something that's going on for me. But again, my life is enriched by people of many faiths and no faith at all. And so how we live together in our diversity is hugely important. And coming out is a piece of that, because we aren't really living together in our diversity when we are hiding things about ourselves that are important, but also that are good aspects of ourselves.
I love that. And it actually kind of leads to the other book that your work, you know, you're bringing to the world about this inequality. And one of the things that I've said many, many times is one of the ways to really understand equality is to treat yourself with equality. If you're hiding yourself, then you're saying, I'm not worthy. I don't deserve to be equal in the eyes of others. And this is a big conversation, Amanda, in my coaching. It's like, I'm not going to ever push anybody. I'm never going to push anybody out of the closet. But when I can see there's a holdback, I bring it to that space of, are you treating yourself as equal as you would like to treat other people? Because you're letting everybody else be who they are, so to speak. And that's usually how I position it, right? But you're not giving yourself that same ability to be who you're meant to be. And oftentimes that's the light bulb that kind of kicks in. Now, in your case, you're talking about the many different cultural processes of inequality that go, they run the gamut, I'm sure, in that book. So as we bring these two intersectionalities together, so to speak, and you set it up so beautifully, like, you know, we've talked about the Christian flourishing and flourishing as a human and helping others flourish. I don't know that we can find equality without having the conversation about flourishing. I don't see any way around it. And I'm curious what you think about that.
That is a fascinating question. So there was this moment when I realized what the intersection was between these two book projects, because there's one concept that is in both books. The book on flourishing has a chapter on flourishing and inequality and how systemic inequality damages or limits flourishing. And one of the concepts I talk about, I didn't come up with it, but I think it's deeply and profoundly important, is the idea of moral exclusion. And a social psychologist came up with this idea, and it is the set of processes by which a group of people determines that an individual or a different group of people falls outside of the moral community of those who should get to be treated morally. So if someone, if you are, if you're homophobic, you, I don't mean you, but if one is homophobic, they probably think that LGBTQ people don't deserve the same rights that the person thinking this deserves. So that person would never think that they should not have the right to learn about their history in school. But they might think that LGBTQ plus people do not have the right to learn about their history in school, or that they should have the right to marry their opposite sex partner, but that I should not have had the right to marry my same sex partner. And so the idea of moral exclusion, it isn't itself sort of, it isn't one of the processes. It sort of sets the framework for looking then at what the specific processes are. But it's so important, because when someone has been morally excluded from a community, their capacity to flourish is really limited, because their need for relationships is harmed. People in that community will not have good relationships with them. Their need for agency may be harmed if their rights are being taken away. For example, we all know about voting suppression. This is a really bad time in the U.S. to be a member of a Black, Indigenous, or person of color community, because conservatives are trying to take their right to vote away. Those conservatives would not want their own rights to vote to be taken away, but they have determined that it's fair game to, and the reason that they can live with themselves doing this is specifically because they have decided that people who tend to vote Democrat are outside of their moral community. So I think where my understanding of inequality and its many cultural forms, and those include things like blaming the victim or the idea of moral alchemy, what's good for one group of people to do is bad for another group if the one group is valued and the other group is devalued. So again, marriage. From a conservative perspective, opposite sex marriage is a good thing, same sex marriage is a bad thing. Yep. There's a logic of thought in that. I think it's personally a distorted logic of thought, but it is a cultural mechanism of inequality. And there's many of them. But in any case, where these two projects come together is in this idea that if we want to have good lives ourselves, if we want to help other people have good lives, if we want a flourishing planet and a flourishing humanity, we are going to have to address inequality in its various forms, cultural, structural, and so on. And where that ties back to coming out has to do with the impact on our individual lives of these cultural messages we receive. So you talked before, you used the word brainwashed when you were talking about your religious upbringing. A sociologist would use the term socialization. We are socialized. We are literally trained in how to see the world and what to think. We learn what's right, what's wrong, and so on. And what we learn depends on who we learn it from, where we are, and so on. And so if we have learned that something about us is wrong or shameful or flawed or an abomination, is religious language you might have run into, then it's going to be hard for us to love ourselves well and treat ourselves well. It's going to be hard for us to resist checking out or to resist addictions or to resist self-destructive behaviors and so on. If we understand that the cultural messages we got about our own badness or shamefulness or inadequacy are incorrect, are wrong, are immoral, then we can start coming into our best selves. So, you know, one question I thought you might ask, so I thought quite a bit about the answer to it, is what are the differences between coming out as a queer bisexual person and coming out as a progressive Christian? And, you know, one of the really big differences is one of those identities is really devalued in society, or at least historically has been, because of homophobia and heterosexism. The other one is more complicated. I mean, Christianity can be very oppressive. It has often been the religion of people who oppress other people. And so I would not say that I grew up getting kind of large cultural messages about how bad Christianity was. It didn't seem to be for me, but it certainly was not a problem the way, you know, homosexuality and bisexuality were problems. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I've really had to grapple with is that my sort of second coming out process around choosing this path and then making it public that I am choosing it and trying to explain to people what I mean by that and how nuanced it is and how I'm not one of those types of Christians and so on, it's both very different from coming out as queer, and yet it has some similarities. And I think that's fascinating, because at the end of the day, I have wound up in circles that largely find religion really suspicious and that see mm-hmm. all the harm it does. And I see all the harm it does. And in fact, I think there are really two completely legitimate responses to how harmful religion is. One of them is to get the hell away from it and not engage with it and protect yourself from it. And I honor that. That's a really important option. Everyone should have it. Another option is to go in, you know, feet first and try to make religion better. Try to make versions of religion that are doing good, and try to make versions of religion that stand up against bad religion and that name bad religion as bad and that say certain kinds of religion harm people. That is not acceptable. That is not moral. That is not in keeping with what religion can be. So there's this funny complexity of choice and a complete lack of choice. I mean, I didn't choose my sexuality in any way. Right. It is what it is, and how I came to accept it and live it out publicly is one thing. But then choosing to opt into a tradition that in so many cases is harmful to people like me, it's complicated and it's delicate. And it requires, again, a lot of nuance and a lot of explanation and a lot of awkwardness. And yet I feel as though moving in that direction deepens my commitment to justice. You know, I don't write about religion at all in the inequality book. It's for sociology classrooms. I'm not going to write about my religious life.
Right.
And yet I do feel as though my sense that this guy a couple thousand years ago had a really beautiful vision, mm-hmm. that does help drive my justice work, my activism, my sociology, my writing. So I'm okay with the complexity of all that.
Well, and I think you brought something up that's really interesting about, you know, the coming out as a progressive Christian, the coming out as bisexual. I always say that everybody's got a coming out story. It's the nuance of what's in the story that makes and creates the differences. You eloquently showed that. And this is something that I often find, this is where we are more similar than different. Everybody is trying to be something more like themselves. Yet we often hide that because we're afraid of, and I love this, kind of the moral exclusions. Like, if I am more of this, if I'm more Christian, if I'm more gay, bisexual, if I'm more Democrat or Republican, we hide these things because there's this moral exclusion that gets tied to so many of these things. And how different would the world be if we could just acknowledge, okay, well, that's interesting. That's how you see the world. Cool. and go do that. And it's always my moral compass always says, as long as what you're doing isn't inherently hurting somebody else, which is the big gray area, like define hurting someone else, right? But I love this intersectionality that you're bringing up here between both of your books, because it's almost like you can't have one conversation without the other, yet they can both stand beautifully on their own. And that's what I love about this, is you're showcasing both sides of a very interesting coin of how you move through, like to take a stand as a progressive Christian, a bisexual, but also realize the inequalities that exist, because in certain ways, both of those things, except the bisexuality, can have interpretations of quote learned behavior. And I think that's where so much of the bisexuality piece gets misconstrued. And yet, on the equality side of the fence, you can't learn to be Black. You can't learn to be Hispanic. You can't learn to be, so many of these things that are like, here's where we're pulling the rug out from under so many of these groups, because it's all about power. It isn't about anything else but power. And I always find it really interesting when, and I don't get into a lot of these conversations, but when I feel comfortable enough to go get into that conversation, and say to someone, so tell me, how did you learn to not like somebody who was LGBTQ?
So like, I don't know really, if just, you...
Just a straightforward ask it. And a lot of times it meets with, well, it's not what God said is right. Okay, how did you learn that? Because you actually just answered my question really well. I did not learn to be gay. I did not learn it. It's deep within my heart and soul. That's who I am. No more than you learned how to be heterosexual. You did not learn how to do it. Now, there's pieces of society that taught us how to be more heterosexual or, quote, more gay or bisexual or whatever. Like, and this is where the conformist in me like says, no, go be your bisexual self the way that fits for you. Go be the gay way that fits for you. You do not have to follow the LGBTQ community handbook on this. There isn't really a handbook, but sometimes our own community even tries to make us think there is, right? And so I find this all really interesting. And this was why I wanted you on the podcast, because I felt like these two books, and we haven't had a chance to talk about your queer music as well. It brings it all together in such a beautiful way for those who are really like, okay, help me understand some things I may be struggling to understand. So let's really quickly talk about your music site, because I think that's another piece of the puzzle that deserves some recognition as well. So
sure.
What brought that forward for you?
So the URL for the site is https://queersacredmusic.com. And the reason I call it that, the reason the website has that title, is anyone who is willing to engage with a website of music with that title is someone who I think deserves access to this free use music. There's like 150 scores on there. There's a ton of recordings. There's a ton of YouTube videos. It's all completely free use. Almost all of it is what I would consider progressive sacred music. So usable by Unitarian Universalists, usable by progressive Christians in many different sub-traditions, a whole range of musical styles. There's new texts to traditional hymn tunes. There's new tunes that sound like hymns. There's folk music, there's pop music, there's gospel music, there's a tango on there. So a whole range of stuff. It is probably most useful for congregations that do not have a budget to spend much on music and are looking for new music that fits into progressive sacred values. So very justice focused, very inclusive. I'm very careful that the language I use not be racist or sexist or ableist and so on. And all of it is really about this vision of what the world could be and what we do individually and collectively to get there. Sometimes that's celebration. Sometimes that's lament. Sometimes that's rage. Sometimes that's just gratitude. So there's many, many things on this website. I encourage anyone to go look at it.
Mm-hmm.
No charge for anything. Take what you like. If you like something and listen to it or program it in your worship or use it at a rally. There's a few things mm-hmm. that are good for. And the one last thing I'll say is I have been so surprised by the creativity of people in engaging with this stuff, stuff that I was almost sure only Christians would use, Unitarian Universalists would wind up using, and the reverse. I wrote a song called All of Who I Am that initially was meant to address mental health struggles, and it has become a trans pride anthem. Who knew? I love that. You know, so the world, there is so much suffering and so much injustice, so many power struggles. You know, I fear for the state of our society in many ways, and yet there's so much beauty out there, so much kindness, so much goodness. Let's keep amping up the beauty and the kindness, the goodness, the compassion, the love, and let's work against our own worst tendencies and the worst tendencies we see in others, because there is a lot to celebrate and there's a lot to be joyful about.
You just brought it home. I was like, okay, well, we're going to wind this up, and you just wound it up so beautifully, because I think I love that, looking at each other's worst tendencies and really observing that, you know, it's very easy to get caught in them. You know, you're wrong. You're in the wrong. You're not. Da, 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 da. And it's hard. Trust me. It's very hard for any of us, I believe. But the more we say, I'm going to give myself the power to step into this and try my best, the easier it becomes, and the easier it becomes, and the easier it becomes. So, Amanda, I so appreciate you giving time to me and my listeners. And listeners, everything will be on the website, everywhere to reach out and touch her, get her books, get her music. And thank you for being just a beautiful beacon of light of, you can be progressive, you can be Christian, you can look through a equality lens and see the beauty in everyone and their own equality journey. I really appreciate every bit of that, Amanda. So again, thank you for being here and being part of Life Uncloseted.
Thanks so much.
Hey, Life Uncloseted family. Another episode of Life Uncloseted has come to an end, and it is time for all of us to sashay away and go face our fears, make those bold moves, and stand up to living our life without apology. But before you do, I've got a favor to ask of you. Would you hop over to iTunes or Spotify or Podbean or wherever it is that you're listening to this, and just give us a little bit of love if you like what we're doing here at Life Uncloseted. Here's what it does. It helps other people find the show. It helps other people get to know what we're all about. And you just might help change life. In fact, if you really want to change a life, we'd love it if you just ask a friend to take a listen and see what they think. So that's it. Love you all deeply. I'm Rick Clemons, the host of Life Uncloseted. And never stop stepping out, stepping up, and stepping in to living your life uncloseted.